www.macromedia.com.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com. I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It feels like soft butter or raw egg to the touch. It's weighty like a gallon of milk, but compact like a softball. And with more connections than there are stars in the universe, the human brain is the most complex computer there is. It's also at the center of important research into the biology of suicide. By analyzing brain slices thinner than human hair, researchers at Columbia University are using science to try to answer the why that haunts loved ones left behind. Brains of suicide victims are compared against those of people who died of natural causes, translucent slice by translucent slice. After nearly 20 years, the research has finally yielded important new clues. There is a potential culprit, a mood-regulating chemical called serotonin. And there is a specific region of the brain where the wiring can go wrong, the prefrontal cortex right behind the forehead. There's plenty yet to unravel, but new findings could change the way mental illnesses are diagnosed and treated. Connection listeners, what questions about suicide do you want science to answer? How could the science change the way society deals with and talks about suicide? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me on the line now is Dr. Victoria Arango. She is Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the New York State Psychiatric Institute at Columbia University. She's the principal investigator into research that is trying to determine the neuropathology of suicide. We're going to find out what that means in just a moment. Also joining us is Carol Ezell, a writer and editor for Scientific American, who writes about Dr. Arango and her colleagues' findings in the current issue of that magazine. Carol, I want to start with you because you have a very personal interest in Victoria's work, and I wonder if you'd share that story with us.
Sure. Unfortunately, I am what they term a survivor of suicide. My mother died by suicide in 1994, and she had suffered from manic depressive illness and throughout her life, but the actual act of her dying by suicide was very spontaneous. It was only a couple days after we had come back from a very happy family vacation, and I would not have predicted that that she would have taken her life on that day.
So it must have been all the more shocking for that. How old were you when you became aware of your mother's illness, and how did it manifest?
I always knew that Mother had very strong mood swings, very severe mood swings, oscillating from depression to being very happy. And sometimes the happiness would spiral off into being annoying, talking too much, talking incessantly, not making sense, doing inappropriate behaviors. So we didn't really have a name for it until I was a teenager. But before that, we just sort of referred to it as, you know, mother's moods.
And so you began this journey searching for answers, and particularly, I would imagine, why, you know, what drove her to it. Where did that journey take you?
Well, the first, as a person who covers science and medicine for about 15 years now, after Mother died by suicide, I immediately, the question that's always on your mind is why, and always wanting to come up with a sort of an answer, justification for that question. And it's a bottomless pit, that question. You can really actually never answer that question. And I say in the article that that's the hardest thing that I have to come to terms with, is that you can never actually definitively answer the question why. But given my interest in biomedicine and science, and neuroscience in particular, I started looking into what scientists were exploring when it comes to the reasons for suicide and any differences between the brains of suicide victims versus people who don't die by suicide. And my when I started looking into this, it led me to the work of Dr. Arango and her colleague, Dr. John Mann, at Columbia.
That sounds like a perfect segue, Dr. Arango. I wonder what prompted your interest in this field?
Well, to tell you the truth, I have also have suicide in the family, not as close as Carol has, but also when I was in graduate school, one of my classmates, who happened to be a medical student, killed herself. And actually, she used my pharmacology book to do so. And I was always very touched by that. But in reality, the opportunity just presented itself when I graduated and I was looking for a postdoctoral fellowship. And I just followed an ad in which this kind of job was offered. And that was back in 1985, and it was John Mann, and we have worked together ever since.
And so you are now studying the neuropathology of suicide. Would you explain what that means exactly?
Yes. So we are. When I started working on this, there were clues that the brains of people who committed suicide may be different from those who did not. And work had begun 30 or more years ago by researchers who took the brain, homogenized it, that means mushed it up, and extracted chemicals from it. And there was the discovery that serotonin, or actually the metabolite of serotonin, the degradation molecules of serotonin, were lower in the brains of people who committed suicide.
Can we just stop, excuse me, for just 1 second? Give us a quick primer, if you will, on serotonin, what it is, what it does.
So serotonin is one of the neurotransmitters in the brain and actually in the gut as well. But it's one of the chemicals that neurons or brain cells use to communicate with each other. There are others, like noradrenaline, so norepinephrine, GABA. There are other neurotransmitters. There are actually multiple ones, but serotonin is one of them. And it has been involved not only in, today we know that it's involved in many functions, not only depression and maybe other psychiatric disorders, but normal functions such as sleep, eating, sexual behavior, etc.
And now, Dr. Arango, where did the brains that you are studying come from?
Well, we had been in association with the coroner office in Pittsburgh and also with the medical examiner in New York City, where we collected brains up until about 2 years ago. We have an agreement at both offices in which we will approach the families at the time of death, and we will request permission to to use part of the brains of their loved ones for research.
And they have been willing to do that, clearly?
Yes, actually, they're usually quite interested in participating, especially if their loved ones have died by suicide. It's a little bit harder to get the accident victims and the people who were not sick, so to speak. But in general, people find it very useful to be able to be useful to science and to other people that may experience these losses. Part of the process of our brain collection is not only studying the brain biochemically, but having very thorough examination psychologically of those subjects. And that involves the interviews with next of kin, family members, friends, etc., who will be able to tell us about the psychiatric problems of this person.
And Carol, when you began to realize that perhaps there were anatomical and chemical differences in the brains of people who commit suicide versus those who die of other causes, did that make you feel at all better about the way in which your mother chose to end her life?
It sort of helped me to process it, yes. I mean, biology is not destiny, as I'm sure Dr. Arango will tell you. It's a combination, and in the article I quote her as saying, this behavior of suicide is a combination of psychology, life experience, and an underlying biological predisposition. So it did help me process that to add another explanation to that question of why. And particularly, it helped to be to probe it intellectually and to feel that I had explored the question as much as it could be explored by the best people who are studying the question.
Because inevitably, I would have to think that families do feel guilty, or why didn't I know? What could I have done about it? You know, what would be your sense on that?
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of guilt that remains when you're left behind by someone who dies by suicide, because you go through the what if I had done this, what if I hadn't done that, if I had only, my mother used a handgun, and she shot herself in the heart. And what went immediately through my mind and the mind of my stepfather is, we shouldn't have had that gun in her house. We should have done something with that gun. I mean, she would have been angry because she had wanted to have access to the gun and learn to shoot it, because my stepfather traveled a lot, and she wanted to think that she could protect herself if there was an intruder or something. But often I thought, if I had only, when I had been visiting, just snuck into her room, I knew where the gun was, just tucked it into my luggage and taken it, you know, what would have happened? But as the more of the research that I did into the causes of suicide, and the more people I talked to who are survivors of suicide, it seems that if you thwart someone one way, they're going to find another way if they're determined.
Dr. Arango, when you met Carol, did you feel better about the fact that your research could offer her some comfort?
Oh, certainly. One of the greatest joys in my work is to be able to tell somebody that, the person who actually committed suicide couldn't help himself or herself. You know, it's something that within their brain that prevented them from inhibiting the self-destructive tendencies that they had. So that there's nothing that the survivor could have done to prevent that, other than perhaps improving our therapeutic abilities to keep preventing that suicide. But it's not in the hands of the survivors right now. I think it's in the hands of science, and it's in the hands of clinicians who will be able to adequately treat these patients to be able to prevent them from committing suicide.
And we'll be continuing our conversation in just a moment. We're exploring the biology of self-destructive behavior this hour. Connection listeners, what questions do you hope science can answer about suicide? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University, this is W.
I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. We're talking about the science of suicide this hour with my guest, Dr. Victoria Arango from Columbia University, and Carol Ezell from Scientific American. Carol, you do a really remarkable job in the current issue of Scientific American of explaining Dr. Arango and her colleagues' research in terms that even lay people like me can understand very clearly. I want to talk about some of those pictures that you paint for us about the labs and the research. But I want to ask you, first of all, what you found most surprising as you began working on this story?
I think the thing that really shocked me is as I was beginning to work on the article and talking about it with friends and kind of friends of friends, some of whom I didn't even tell that I was going to tell the story of my mother's suicide and some of whom didn't even know about my mother's suicide. But I would, you know, mention that I was working on this article, and spontaneous stories of people who had had suicide as a part of their lives came bubbling out all over. It was just shocking to me how many people I knew who had had a loved one, a family member, a close friend who had died by suicide. And it turned out that there were just so many stories. It was very surprising. I think that was probably the most surprising thing about working on the story. The most surprising thing about looking into the research, I guess, would be that, I mean, there was one thing that Dr. Arango said to me that I also quote in the article that was very startling. It's when you're talking about the serotonin system in the brain and how the brains of people who go on to commit suicide, they're trying to make and use as much serotonin as they can, but the equipment there is just not sufficient, and they can't make and use enough of it. And she said to me, she says, you know, sometimes people are so sick that Prozac can't help them. Even Prozac can't help them. And Prozac, as the listeners may or may not know, works by preventing the reuptake of serotonin from the brain, so it lets the serotonin stick around long enough or longer in the brain to exert its sort of soothing effect.
Dr. Arango, I want to turn to you. Was there an aha moment for you when this all seemed to be clear about the connection between serotonin and the fact that there are more transporters than receptors? And I should probably ask you to explain how that works, too.
Well, actually, first of all, let's make absolutely clear that the changes in the brain are quite subtle. It really takes a lot to be able to see them. Many, many times you cannot see them in one particular brain. You need to study many brains to be able to look at them as a group. And within that group, there are people who are not going to exhibit those changes necessarily, at least that we're going to be able to detect them on an individual basis. But as a group, was there a particular moment? Well, I think that the knowledge that we have accumulated about suicide is incremental, if you will, a little at a time. The big thing that I wanted to do when I started working on this was take the pieces of brain tissue that were taken and sort of mushed up, homogenized, and I wanted to make it into slices. I wanted to be able to see, to localize each layer of the cortex, each part of the brain where these receptors were altered or where this neurotransmitter was altered. And that's when I was most rewarded by being able to see where exactly in the brain, not in general, but where exactly in the brain these changes were occurring.
And that was where?
And that is when we started to look at the orbital prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that sits in your forehead right in top of your eye. And it was in that part where most of the changes that we see in suicide converged.
And so what did that tell you?
So first let me tell you about the more or less receptors, okay? So serotonin is made in the back of the brain, in the brain stem, by a whole bunch of neurons that are there and that actually send their connections all throughout the brain. And the, like Harold said, the serotonin transporter receptor sits at the end of that connection, and it picks up serotonin to be able to recycle it, because the brain is very efficient and wants to recycle the serotonin that it released. And there are fewer of those recycling receptors. There are fewer of those reuptake receptors in people who commit suicide. Now, that is indicative of less serotonin connections. And on the other side of that synapse, of that connection, there is what we call a postsynaptic receptor. And those receptors are increased. They are increased as a result of the less serotonin, because they're trying to make more, the brain is trying to compensate for the lack of serotonin. So it has more receptors, so every little molecule of serotonin that is there will be able to bind to a receptor. And so those are the receptor changes that we find in suicide.
Dr. Rengel, we want to take a call in just a moment, but first let me ask you quickly, the role of the prefrontal cortex, what happens in that part of the brain?
So in that part of the brain, then it's the part of the brain that deals with behavioral inhibition. It makes us be civil to someone that we want to kill. It really makes us control our words when we really don't feel like being nice to somebody. It also makes us control our instincts for inadequate behaviors. And the most inadequate of behaviors, really, is wanting to kill oneself. So that is in that part of the brain has a lot to do with behavioral inhibition, with suppressing the self-injurious tendencies of a person. And that's why I said that in that part of the brain is where most of these changes, where the changes were most pronounced in people who committed suicide.
All right, let's bring some of our listeners into the discussion. I know there are a lot of people who want to be part of this. Let's go first to Manchester, New Hampshire, and Anne. Anne.
Good morning, and thank you for going to the details of the study. Really, as an ignorant layperson, I've wondered over time whether trauma or life's difficulties over a dark period of time, which drain the psychic energy of an otherwise healthy person, whether they can affect the neurotransmitters in a way that stress affects cortisol in the body, and therefore the serotonin decrease, might it be as much an effect as a cause in the suicidal?
Anne, you sound way better informed than the average layperson, I have to tell you.
You don't sound like a layperson.
Dr. Rengel?
Certainly, you know, we started by saying that biology does not lead to suicide by itself. Suicide is very complicated. Life events have to do with it. Cortisol, life stressors have to do with it. Losing support has to do with it. The most important thing is having a psychiatric diagnosis, meaning being mentally ill. 90% of people who commit suicide have a disease, have a mental disease. And the stressors certainly are going to affect it. But I really don't think that a person is going to kill themselves if they don't have the predisposition. It may be like, it appears like a healthy person. I know that I have the predisposition because there is suicide in my family. And yet I feel that I'm healthy, and I hope that I'll be able to control whatever other bad things happen to me and be able to seek help before I do something stupid because I know that. But so without the biological predisposition, we cannot know, but I don't believe that a person is going to go ahead and make an attempt.
Thank you, and for your research.
If I could just add a little bit more to that, this this other research going on that shows that early childhood trauma can really change the neuroendocrine, the neurohormonal system of people. And there's a hypothesis that that actually can prime for depression in later life and that sort of thing. So it's really clear that life experience shapes the biology of the brain as much as the biology of the brain shapes behavior.
And following up on that point about depression later in life, we have a call from Michael, who is calling in from Boston. And Michael, you have a personal story to tell as well.
Yeah, actually I do. Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. And this is a really timely topic for me because my grandfather actually committed suicide about a week and a half ago. And I'm wondering if the guests could comment on the, you know, just the encroachment of age and what that has to do with just the physical aspects of suicide.
Yeah. Well, the suicide rates vary across the age spectrum. They are higher in children and in teenagers, and they are higher in elderly people. I think that in children and teenagers, a lot of it has to do with perhaps the use of drugs and alcohol. With older adults, it may have to do with the lack of support systems, the life events that they're experiencing, the losses that they're experiencing, the physical illnesses that they have, and it's in a way, you know, more understandable because of the failure of all of the other systems that have to do with suicide attempt and completion.
Yeah, it's actually. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Matt. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that I had I was in the gym the other day and had a copy of this article with me, and a woman started to ask me about it, and then said that her mother, who was 92 years old, had recently jumped out of her seventh floor apartment window, and she couldn't understand why someone who had lived to be the ripe old age of 92 and had no worse health than, you know, a lot better health than many, say, 62 or 72-year-olds decided to end her life. And, yeah, the incidence does increase towards the end of life.
Yeah, it's been, you know, it's just been a very hard thing for our family to deal with, because as far as we knew, he was in really good health, and he didn't leave a suicide note, and it has just taken everyone by total shock. And doing research after it, I'm very surprised at, I guess, that it's like six times the average for individuals who, white males who have lived past the age of 80. And,
it is, Michael, you're right, absolutely. 85 and older, die by suicide six times the overall national rate. So, mm-hmm. So clearly he was not alone.
Yeah, and that's one thing that we can take comfort in, is that there are other people who are going through this.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Michael. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Rango, I want to ask about the correlation that you found between serotonin-based activity and some of the more dangerous or horrific means of committing suicide, jumping off buildings, for example. You've been at this for 16 years, and that's one of the things that you found. How did that show up?
Well, actually, I didn't find that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's okay. I only, because I'm a purist in trying to understand the biology of suicide, I only study people who die by violent means. So that excludes everybody who has taken drugs or, you know, or even carbon monoxide poisoning. So in reality, we only study the ones that use the most aggressive means, only the ones who kill themselves by gunshot wounds, by hanging, or by jumping. The reason that we do that is because the drugs will be confounds in the study of the biochemistry of suicide. The receptors will change with drugs. They will even change with alcohol. So we have to be, the cases that we study have to be pure without any drugs on board. But yes, you're right that risk-taking behaviors are associated with less serotonin. There's actually a wealth of information that we get from monkey studies, from Dr. Higley at the NIH, where they find that the monkeys with the highest risk-taking behaviors are the ones that have less of the serotonin metabolites in the cerebrospinal fluid, and they do studies. And they've also have managed to do a lot of rearing studies in which they show that it's the early events in life that have the most lasting effects in the levels of serotonin throughout life, therefore conferring that biological vulnerability, if you will.
And you also mentioned a moment ago that there was a family link, and one of the things that people look into is the hereditary link, that
right.
The offspring of people who commit suicide are 6 times more likely to as well. How does that affect the question of trying to predict who might be in danger? I mean, would you want to take some kind of test that might indicate how your serotonin levels were doing?
Well, ideally, what you will need to assess, like I said, one of the telltale signs is that you need to have a psychiatric diagnosis, okay, for a person to be at risk, in addition to the family history, at least for the majority of them. And ideally, what we would like to do is to be able to investigate or look for the same changes that we find postmortem in the brains that we've studied in people in the clinic. And we have people, some of my colleagues at Columbia University are doing just that. They are studying receptors, the same receptors we study in the brains of people who have killed themselves, and using PET studies, and they're trying to identify...
I'm sorry, can you tell us what PET studies are?
There is a positron emission tomography. They put the live person inside a camera. They inject them with a tracer, meaning that there is a very short-lived radioactive molecule that binds to the serotonin receptor. And then you'll be able to see the same in live people as you do see in the lab, in the slices that I study. And by doing this, we hope to be able to identify people who are at risk so that they can be better followed, better watched for, better medicated to prevent this from happening.
Hold the thought. We'll be continuing that conversation in just a moment. Connection listeners, science is trying to help answer questions about suicide. How could those answers impact the way that mental illnesses are treated and diagnosed? We'll ask our guests, and we'll take more of your questions next on The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Welcome back to The Connection. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, Dr. Victoria Arango and Carol Ezell are my guests today. And Victoria, I want to start with you. Your research into the neuropathology of suicide continues. I'm wondering what you hope to find next.
Well, like I said, what we hope to find next is the test, the connection to on moving my research from the bench to the clinic. And we're still a little far away from that because we are able to look at the brain in the lab with very high resolution and with the cameras to be able to study people. Still the resolution is not quite there. And we also have to perfect the chemicals that we radiolabel to be able to inject them into people so that they'll be totally comparable to the ones that we use to study in vitro. It will be incredibly, you know, the greatest accomplishment, I think, it will be to be able to identify the person who is truly at risk, that the clinician be able to identify the person who is truly at risk of killing themselves, because I understand that is the most difficult thing to see. Like in the case of Carol's mother, you know, she really didn't think that it was right then and there that her mother was going to kill herself because she seemed so well and she was so happy. So I've also seen people in hospital who have been hospitalized and they are on suicide watch and somehow being looked at every 15 minutes, they still manage to kill themselves. So it will be a great accomplishment to be able to identify a something in the brain that can be seen so that it can be applied to the clinic.
I think, too, though, that the next step after Dr. Rengo is able to, you know, make these findings to identify people who are most at risk is there needs to be a lot more research going into how to prevent suicide. Because as she mentioned, so many people, despite the fact that they have a diagnosed mental disease, despite the fact that they might be in a psychiatric ward or that they're that their loved ones are looking after them carefully after they've gotten out of a psychiatric ward and they're taking what is thought to be the optimum treatment, they still end up killing themselves. And so the hope, my hope as someone with a family history of suicide is that once these markers for suicide tendencies are identified, that then that will lead to a better understanding of how to prevent the act of suicide.
Let's bring in one of our listeners now. Susan is calling from Madison, Wisconsin, and you have personal experience with this as well.
Yes. My brother took his life 20 years ago. And in my efforts to understand what was happening, one of the things that I've realized, and I am so appreciative of the work that this woman is doing, and I'm appreciative of you bringing it to the public, because I think that's one of the gaps. We need to get information about depression and suicide, and so that people can realize that people who have depression and mental illnesses seriously have illnesses just like cancer. And that knowing the signs and symptoms, which doesn't have to be done by a clinician, which really should be happening in our everyday life, just like it is for the American Heart Association, so that we can get some of these signs and symptoms of depression out so that we can really save lives in the meantime.
Carol, I'd like a response from you on that, if you will. And also, I'm wondering whether you feel that this kind of work helps remove the stigma of suicide.
Yeah, actually, we were talking about this, Victoria and I, just before we came into the studio. First of all, I'm very sorry, caller, to hear about your brother. I'm sure you know the immense stigma that's connected to being a family member of someone who's died by suicide. People treat you much differently. I mean, even now, if it's been almost 10 years since my mother died by suicide, and people who say I hadn't talked about it with before, who are finding out now, there's a little subtle shift in behavior. People don't know what to say. It's a conversation stopper, and because there is still the incredible stigma. But I really think the only way to counter a stigma is to talk. And, you know, just like with years ago, people used to whisper about cancer. And if someone in the family had cancer, they didn't want other people to know. And then, you know, I think HIV/AIDS really raised a lot of consciousness in this respect by trying to overcome stigma and saying it's a virus, it's not a moral judgment. The same thing needs to be done with mental health and suicide. And that's honestly one of the reasons why I wanted to write about it and write about my personal experience and talk about it.
Education is the way that we're going to achieve this. I think that it really should be, you know, I'm very grateful to Carol and to you, Gail, for doing this. But we really need to educate the public about it. And we need to make sure that people do not feel stigmatized by it. That, you know, it's like it's an illness just like any other illness. It makes the family members feel so much better about it. It takes some of the guilt away. You know, it takes some of the accompanying feelings away because it's just like tuberculosis a number of years ago. Oh, my goodness, don't let anybody know that this person had tuberculosis. Go burn their mattress and all of this. So education in terms of mental illness is crucial.
Susan, thank you so much for the call. Was there anything else you wanted to mention?
Yes, I would also like to mention that there is a movement nationwide by a group called SPAN, Suicide Prevention Advocacy Network, and they have a website, spanusa.org. And what we're doing is exactly what you're doing, what you're talking about, is that we are going out in the public as people who've lost people to suicide and saying, this is just like any other illness. And so we are going out publicly, and we go meet in Washington, and we have an awareness day, and many of the states have awareness days in their own capitals, as we do. So there is a lot going on, and I think as we partner with the people from education, the people that have had the personal experience, bring the passion, and we want to bring the passion to the scientists so that they know that what they're doing makes a huge difference, because it does to our families.
Thank you so much for the call, Susan, and we encourage all of your good efforts.
Gail, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention is another very good organization that which I have been involved with for many years, and they not only have a lot of money to fund suicide research, but also to reach out to families and survivors of suicide and to educate the public in this manner.
All right, we have another caller online now. Rhea is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Go ahead, Rhea.
Oh, hi. I would like to say that this whole theory, or whatever, not theory, but this whole worldview seems very, very circular logic. It's like saying people get unhappy because of serotonin problems, and they kill themselves because of a little thing in their brain. And if you know that somebody has killed themselves, and you see, you look at someone's brain and it says this mechanism called, you know, caused them to kill themselves, that's to me like saying they killed themselves because they killed themselves, and doesn't deal with any of the internal realities of the people. It doesn't say why did they feel sad, what could have made them feel better. I mean, this whole point of this seems like, at least of the show, not necessarily of the theory, seems to be like, okay, you're a family member, you couldn't have done anything possibly ever, you know what I mean? And no one could do anything unless you have a degree you have a psychological degree. So in other words, it's not up to the person, it's not up to the family, it's up to people who have degrees. You know what I mean? People who are, I'm the therapist or whatever, you know what I mean? They're the only ones with the power, not the person and not the family, you know what I mean? It's a very, very fatalistic. It's like someone's listening to the show and they have, you know, life problems or whatever. They're going to think, I don't have any choice except to go and see a professional. So if they don't want to see a professional, what can they do? They can't do anything, right? I don't believe that. I think that we have determination over our own lives, you know what I mean?
All right, let's find out what Victoria and Carol have to say about that.
I think the most important thing is to remember is what we said earlier, is that biology is not destiny. You can have a genetic predisposition to high cholesterol, and yet if you exercise and have a healthy lifestyle, you're not going to die of heart disease necessarily. So there is a biological component. There can't help but be. The brain is an organ. But the thing I said earlier about experience and behavior affecting the brain, I mean, they know, neuroscientists who study learning and memory, they know that they can actually see changes in the connections between neurons after someone, an animal or a person learns a new thing. So there's definitely an effect of experience on biology, but also biology on experience. And it's not that it's circular logic, it's just a feedback thing. The two are connected and they're interconnected. Whether or not that lets you off the hook, as it were, for guilt as a survivor, for me, no. I mean, knowing that there was a biological component to my mother's suicide doesn't automatically make me feel that I had no role in preventing her suicide. It just adds another layer in trying to process it.
And what are the implications for treatment then, Dr. Arango? Let me turn to you. How do you think the medical and mental health community should respond to your findings?
Well, I really believe that one of the problems of suicide completion is that people who are suicidal are under-treated. They are under-medicated. Apparently, a lot of people, or most of the people who have killed themselves, have seen a physician recently. And what we need to do is to educate the physicians out there not to be afraid to administer effective dosages of antidepressants. Unfortunately, not all of antidepressants are perfectly fine. Like Carol said earlier, the sickest people are the ones that are not going to be helped by medication, unfortunately, because the medication doesn't have the same transmitter that they need to act upon to be effective. But, you know, we're still learning. We're still looking for other medications that would be effective on this. And we cannot give up. But it's educating the general practitioner in the small town. Everybody's going to see an internist. Everybody's going to see a general medicine doctor. Educating that doctor in what the signs of depression are, what the signs of suicide are, and making sure that those people that get at least get the adequate therapeutic treatment.
If I could just add to that, my mother actually was, because of the stigma that surrounds mental illness, she was reluctant to see a psychiatrist. And so she was on Prozac, and she was getting it from her OBGYN, her gynecologist, who was essentially her primary care physician. And she, in my mind, was not getting the best treatment, in part because she was rejecting the best treatment herself, but also because she wasn't being offered the best treatment. So Dr. Arango and her colleague Dr. Mann are doing a project actually in Hungary right now, which has one of the world's highest incidences of suicide, where they're trying to educate primary care physicians to recognize depression, recognize propensity to suicide, and treat it.
Well, we thank you both so much today for helping to educate us and our listeners on this important topic. My guests have been Victoria Arango. She is Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the New York State Psychiatric Institute at Columbia University. And Carol Ezell is a writer and editor at Scientific American. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation in our online forums at theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Orit Kuritsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. Coming up.